She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, an inspirational and informative place where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and we're going to give you lots of really interesting, fun, entertaining, educational, and amazing things to think about for this next hour. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our sponsor of this show, Tanks Green Stuff. Tanks Green Stuff is an organic compost product made from landscape trimming. So what would be green waste that would otherwise go to the landfill? Their compost is made using the most stringent criteria to ensure quality, purity, and consistency. Tanks Green Stuff 100% organic soil amendment contains no fertilizer or petrochemical additives. At Tanks, they test for vital nutrients, pathogens, and heavy metals to make sure that their award-winning compost is the best and highest quality available always. Thanks to them for their support of our mission and vision and for their support of a healthy planet. So everybody, take a deep breath. I'm smiling. I'm sure you can hear it in my voice. What an incredible, delightful, fun, and informative treat we have in store for you now. We're going to be talking about Polyface, the farm of many faces, but it's the who we're going to be talking to that is beyond exciting. I wrote in my show write-up that spending time with Joel Salatin is on my bucket list. So, Joel, you made my bucket list, and I hope that happens.
Well, thank you. I do, too. That's wonderful.
I really mean it. So when I wrote up and then I got some show notes from somebody on your team, I had to put this in. He calls himself a Christian, libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic farmer. So need I say more about what the show is going to be like? Joel and his family own and operate Polyface Farms. And is it Swope?
Yes.
Virginia. Swope. I love it. And in addition to that, I mean, I can just spend the whole show talking about what Joel does. He's the editor, I believe, of Stockman Grass Farmer. It's the grazing publication in North America. He's written over 10 books. Just watch his YouTube video when he presented to Google if you want to get a sense of what he's done. And he's going to be talking with us about the farm of many faces. He appeared in Food, Inc. He's featured in Omnivore's Dilemma, the National New York Times bestseller. And so that I stop rushing and tripping over my words, I want as much of this show to be your voice, Joel Salatin, and thank you for saying yes.
Oh, it's my honor and pleasure. Yes, we in this world we call this stoking the boiler.
So, yes. And the more listeners I get, the hotter the boiler gets. And
that's,
you know,
right.
I always struggle with the best place to start, but where I would love for you to start is the story. Like, I wanted to read a whole book about how the farm was started, because it's worth it. So can you just tell us how Polyface Farm started and how it came to be in the first place?
Sure. Well, I'm second generation, so I have to go back. My grandfather was a charter subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine in 1949. A lot of people don't realize the watershed that occurred in this country post World War II, when a lot of farmers were still using, you know, mules and draft power. You know, chemicals were here, but they were still nascent in the countryside, and there was a real, you know, tug of war push. Are we going to go this way or that way? And, of course, there were big names at that time. You know, Lewis Bromfield was up for Secretary of Agriculture. His buddy Ed Faulkner wrote Plowman's Folly that sold 500,000 copies in 6 months. Who would guess that a book the title Plowman's Folly would sell 500,000 copies in 6 months?
I would not.
Yeah. So this was all, and so my grandfather, and of course Rodale was just developing the word organic, and my grandfather threw in with that lot. He had compost pile and this wonderful big backyard. My dad then got his kind of environmental deal from his dad. But dad was also a very much a tinkerer, craftsman, and economist. His degree was in economics. He always wanted to have a farm in a developing country. So after flying bombers in World War II, he went to Indiana University on the GI Bill, got his degree in economics, and went to Venezuela with Texas Oil Company as a bilingual accountant. And it took him 7 years to put together enough money to buy a 1,000-acre farm in Venezuela. They came back to have us kids. So we were down there. We were farming. We were full-time. He left Texas Oil then. We were full-time farmers there in the late 50s, right when there was a big junta. That's what they call, a coup.
Yes.
And the ouster of Pérez Jiménez was the dictator essentially we fled the back doors. The guerrillas came in the front door with the machine guns, and we fled for our lives and lost everything, left everything. Spent an extra 6 months trying to visit all the interior, the Department of Interior, the Secretary of this, that, and the other, all the upper level, and they were all scared they were going to be assassinated. No, Señor Saladin, we can't help you. And so there was nothing to do but get on a ship and come back to the U.S., which we did. Landed in Philadelphia Easter Sunday, 1961.
Wow.
And to his credit, Dad was 40. I remember when I hit 40, which was 21 years ago. I thought, man, if I lost it all, would I have the gumption to start over? And so, it's one of these stories of the older I get, the more whatever, the greater Dad gets in my. He's no longer with us, but his convictional savvy just is truly a gift. And so we looked at farms. He was still hoping to go back once the coup was over and things settled down. And so we looked at farms within a day's drive of Washington, D.C., so he could get to the embassy, the Venezuelan embassy, quickly if things changed. They did not, and we did not, but we did settle here within 3 hours of Washington, D.C., on the most run-down, gullied rock pile we could find because it was cheap. And it would have been abused and lost, 5 feet of topsoil since the European conquest, and began the slow process of rebuilding. Mom was a high school phys ed teacher. Dad was an accountant. So they worked. Mom was a school teacher. Dad was an accountant. They worked off the farm in order to pay for it, that song and dance. And it took about 10 or 11 years to actually finish paying the mortgage, but finally did. So by the time I was coming on as an 11, 12-year-old, the pressure of indebtedness was off, but it was not a going concern. But Dad was very much an experimenter, and he developed probably one of the most vivid memories of my childhood was one Sunday afternoon. I was maybe 7, 8 years old. Dad said, I met this guy, we're going to go see him. And we drove, I don't even know where it was, how far away it was, but it was a Sunday afternoon. We went to see this guy, and he had these portable A-frame houses in a pasture. And I remember coming home, Dad he literally levitated off the seat of the car in excitement about this portable infrastructure. The notion that you could have a farm without stationary buildings. I mean, it revolutionizes the capital intensity. It revolutionizes your flexibility to be able to to adjust to changing market things and all that. And so he realized very early on that as a small farm, we had to direct market, we had to do something in craft based, not commodity based, and that's the path we started down. And so when I came along, I got my first chickens at 10. I had my customers, I put them on my bicycle, pedaled them around the block, and supplied a couple schools. We had a curb market in town I'd take them to. So all through high school, I was up at 4 o'clock every single Saturday morning, every Saturday morning of the year, from like 13 years old to 18. And because I was a salesman, I was the salesman in the family. And so I was down there selling my eggs, chicken, garden produce. We in those days, we could actually dress a cow or a pig in the field and take it down to market. I had eggs. We milked two Guernsey cows, so we made butter, buttermilk, cottage cheese, yogurt, sold all that. And this was in the 70s, right before, you know, just in the Vietnam era, right during the hippie time, and right before what we now see as the whole, you know, kind of localization, organic, ecological innovation. I mean, this was just before La Leche League and Lamaze, and you know, and the reappreciation of nursing babies, you know, breastfeeding. All that stuff was just, you know, it was nascent. And so I always say we were just 20 years ahead of our time. We were just too early. And then, you know, when I went to college, I shut everything down. Nobody else in the family wanted to do the market stand and all that. So when I came back from school, well, now where do we start? Because I wanted to farm, and I wanted to farm from my earliest days. Well, how do I do this farm? And so I made a business plan of where I would milk 10 cows by hand and sell the milk at regular grocery store prices to neighbors, and I'd make a nice living with 10 cows on grass, you know, just selling milk to the neighbors. Only one problem. It was illegal. And I've never, you know, so when you say my title with that libertarian in there, you know, our experience in Venezuela, and I won't, you know, bore people with all that whole deal, but that pretty much quashed our faith in governments. It certainly quashed our faith in foreign aid and all that, you know, kind of empire-building machinations around the world. And then this, where, you know, I had neighbors that wanted to milk, I wanted to be on the farm full-time. But I've never really I've forgiven but not forgotten the fact that the regulations kept me off the farm for several years until we could find another enterprise that was legal. I wasn't doing marijuana, you know, I wasn't doing something
right,
crazy.
It was cows.
It was just milk. Yeah,
it was milk. So revolutionary.
Yeah. And so Therese and I we made an apartment in the attic. And lived on $300 a month, drove a $50 car. We never had a TV. We still don't have a TV. And we just dedicated ourselves to this thing. She was, you know, I always say the greatest part of my success is I married a wife more frugal than I. And so, you know, she canned. We always said if we didn't grow it, we didn't eat it. She canned, like, you know, 800 quarts of stuff a year. By doing all this, we were able to live very cheaply. We had firewood for our heat. We had all of our own food. We could, you know, go to the thrift store and get clothes. And so once we saved up, so she worked off the farm till the first child was born, and I worked off the farm. And it took us a couple of years to save enough to live on. And remember, we didn't need to live on much because we could live on about $300 a month. So it took us a couple of years to save enough to live on for a year. And as soon as that happened, I left the town job. I was a reporter at the local newspaper, and where I worked in high school, and returned to the farm. And we fully expected to run through that nest egg and have to go back out, but we thought, well, the whole time away would be shorter. As it turned out, by being here full time and not having that tension of having to drive to the town job, we were able to say we were here for every weed that grew in the green beans. We were here for every calf that was born. We were here for all that. And so what I call the farm slippage, that slippage of not being timely on things, just went away. And we were able to live even way cheaper than we expected. And there was not the slippage. And it was tight. I mean, you know, we squeaked. But I wouldn't trade those years for anything. And today we have 20 full-time people. You know, it's pushing a $3 million enterprise. We service 5,000 families, 50 restaurants, farmers market, you know, several institutions, and it's life is no better, but the footprint's bigger, I guess.
Yeah, that is to say the least. But let's just, like, press pause here for a minute, because you kind of say, oh, we did this, we did that. But you really didn't follow conventional wisdom, from what my research told me. And look at what fast forward to where you are. You were building compost piles and moving the cows around with portable electric fences.
Yes.
What? How did you know how to do that? I mean, that's you're a reporter, and then all of a sudden you're doing all of these things. There's conventional wisdom, but then look what you did.
Yeah, well, remember, Dad was a genius. I mean, just to give you an example, he in the early 60s, so he was an accountant, all right? So he had to, you know, wear a bow tie or a dress to go to work, right? Well, so he's thinking, you know, what does a farmer do? Farmers always go down and buy, they have a car and they have a pickup truck. Well, he said, I don't want a car and a pickup truck. I want a multi-use vehicle. You know, we talk about multi-speciation, multi-use everything. So what did he do? He went down and went to a neighbor's that had this old 1957 four-door Plymouth and bought it for, I don't know, what, $150 or something. Brought it home. We ripped all the doors off of it, took all the seats out of it. And I mean, this is in the days before seatbelt laws, okay? But we took a galvanized, you know, water bucket, you know, you'd have around the barn, turn it upside down to sit on. And that became a dual purpose. We'd take calves around, we'd take chickens. I mean, we did hay. I mean, that thing, and I mean, you know, we kids could sit in a couple apple crates in the back, you know. And if you take all the seats out of a car and run it all the way from the dashboard back through the trunk, it, you know, it's like 8 feet long. You can carry lumber, you can put all sorts of stuff in there. So here he'd go down the road sitting on his bucket, no doors, no nothing, you know, no seats, and was completely oblivious to peer dependency, peer pressure, anything. And so I think if I look back and say, what is the greatest gift you got from your parents, it was truly a non peer dependency spirit. You know, being scared of stepping out, being a weirdo, it destroys innovation, it destroys dreams and fantasies. And so so he gave us in the family, he gave us license to be outliers, you know, to be lunatics.
Crazy.
That was a
yes, crazy. It's wonderful. Yeah, don't color inside the lines. It's like,
yeah,
because
right. And,
there are no lines.
And, right, and also to be very very conviction based. I remember like yesterday. I don't know how old you are, but I was in high school when the Arab oil embargo. Jimmy Carter was president.
Yep.
And Arab oil embargo happened, and if you lived through that time, you remember that you could only get gasoline if your license tag was an even number. You could get gas on even numbered days, and if it was odd, you had to, you know, you could get on odd numbered days. And so there was this gas rationing, all this stuff going on. And of course, Dad had been in the petroleum business. He'd worked for Texas Oil Company in the Wildcat Ventures off of Puerto La Cruz in Venezuela. And so he knew the oil business. He said, it's ridiculous for us to be held hostage by OPEC and these oil companies. So he went down. He was the accountant, bookkeeper, blueprint guy for a large metal fabrication plant in the area. I mean, I say large. It was a custom plant. They had, I don't know, 20 welders and fabricators and stuff. And so he ran the front office, did all the estimating, you know, purchasing and accounting for the business. And it was about 17 miles away from our house. And he would drive down there. Now, remember, by this time, he's in his 50s, okay? He's in his
right.
50s. And he goes downtown and buys a 10-speed bicycle and starts riding his bicycle to work, riding it 34 miles a day, all right, in his 50s, back and forth. And he said, look, you know, if everybody would just do this, the Arabs can keep their oil, you know? And he was exactly right. But how many people in their 50s in 1970, you know, eight, and of course we kids, you know, we were embarrassed about this. Oh, come on, Dad. Yeah, you know, I'm convinced that the reason we have kids is so somebody will roll their eyes at us, you know?
It is so true. It's like, and my kids say, this is what the voice they get. They go, Mom, no.
Yeah.
That's it. Mom, no. So, believe it or not, this is how I knew the show was going to be. We should have made it a two-hour show, like a fireside chat, but we're up on our first break, and I know that anyone listening will not want to take their finger off the dial of this podcast. So, Joel Salatin, Polyface Farm, the farm of many faces, and there's so many things more that I want to ask you. So, everybody, please stay here with me, and Joel, you can think about this on our 30-second break. What's it like having four generations living on this farm? How crazy is that? We'll be right back.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and SpeakUp networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
And welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and you are indeed listening to Mrs. Green's World, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And usually we give you some really amazing things to think about. And today is no exception. Joining us for this hour is Joel Salatin. And we're talking about Polyface, and it is the farm of many faces. I get joy out of saying this, so I'm going to say it again. A self-professed Christian, libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic farmer. And you got to love that in a person. And what I said to him off air is he is a word storm. He is, I mean, a word storm, and I love it. He's written over 10 books. He did an amazing YouTube video presentation to Google. That's a YouTube video that you can look at, and you won't want to turn it off. He was featured in Food Inc., released in 2009, and I have wanted to interview him since I saw that movie. And he has literally changed the way millions of Americans eat, and I don't think that's an exaggeration at all. So, Joel, I just want to say, you know, just keep talking because it's so great. But how crazy is it with four generations? I mean, your family is arguably crazy in the most wonderful way, non-traditional. Yeah. I mean, I was like a lactivist in the 70s. I don't even think there was that word, but I was one of those Leche nuts who was, pushing the edge of the envelope. So, how is it, this is off topic, but I just wonder when you talk about it, is it crazy hard or crazy wonderful or everything in between?
Absolutely, it's wonderful, but it doesn't mean that there aren't some wonderfully hard moments.
Yes.
When Teresa and I got married, you know, I remember very well, those of people who have read Stephen Covey's iconic book, you know, Seven Habits of Highly
Right.
Effective People,
Right.
know that one of those habits is start with the end in view.
Right.
And as we were talking, we were expecting our first child, Daniel, and what's your expectation in life and everything? And I said, well, my vision is that when I become a grandpa, that my grandkids will fight over who gets to spend the day with grandpa.
Love it.
Which indicates that they will be here, right?
Right, right.
And so early on, even before Dad passed away, and he passed away early, he was only 66, it was in 1988, but before he passed, one of the things that we did, and it's still a paper that I treasure, it's in my goals and objectives file in the filing cabinet, we sat down there in the early 80s, one January 1, you know, nice day to do this, you know, New Year's Day and all that, and said, wonder how many salaries could be generated on this farm? And this was when we were just, we were over the critical hump. We knew we were gonna make it. It took about 3 years for us to realize, okay, we're gonna make it, you know. We're gonna be okay, the Peter Drucker business cycle, you know.
Right.
And so we had just kind of passed through that. Dad, let's do an exercise. Let's do a brainstorming on how many salaries could this little farm support. And so we started brainstorming that afternoon, and I still have the paper, and it's like 22 full-time salaries off of this little farm that we brainstormed back then. Now, we still have not accomplished all of that, but now, of course, if I did the list, the list would be more like, 50. Because we know more, and we just know that there are way more opportunities. What I'm getting at is that very early on, we recognized that sustainability, that a sustainable farm has to have two salaries from two different generations, or it will simply, the farm business, the trajectory will simply follow the physical life cycle of the farmer. And you know, when you're 70, you're not 20, all right?
Right. And I'm 67, so am I really relating to that?
Okay, so you're a little ahead of me.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's like my friend says, you know, when I get up in the morning, if it ain't hurting, it ain't working, you know?
And you don't want to say that out loud. It's like, yeah.
Yeah. No, so yeah, you begin realizing your mortality, and so, you know, if the business has followed your physical trajectory, by the time you're 60, you can't begin to keep up with what you did in your, you know, in your 40s. And so we established very, very early, you know, the average farm, a lot of times farmers don't want a partner. I'm just, you know, that's why I'm a farmer, because I don't like people, you know. So a lot of farmers don't want anybody around, and then what happens is the farm follows their physical trajectory, and then, you know, it gets sold and the business fails. So, but we went from the other direction. We said, goodness, we can't even begin to imagine the abundance that could be on this place. It's not a place of scarcity. It's a place of abundance. And so we set our sights on how do we build a farm business that provides an opportunity for every child, every grandchild, neighbors, friends, you know, how do we create an economic, environmentally abundant engine over the long haul that regenerates itself and provides opportunity for people who want to participate in viscerally touching our ecological womb. How do we do that? And so that created a thought platform, if you will, for how we made decisions, organized ourselves, and that sort of thing. So now, you know, what's cool is, having articulated that vision, our grandkids are all here on the farm, and they fight over who gets to spend the day with Grandpa. So,
you know, begin with the end in mind, and that's like
begin with the end in view.
My husband sometimes says, "I'm sorry, go ahead."
Well, they're now 14. 12 and 10, and so they're actually turning into people, and it's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool, and my husband says, kiddingly, that next time he's going to skip the children and have grandchildren, and of course, my kids know he doesn't mean it, but it's the delight in that whole picture you paint of that. You know, I don't know if you've been asked this. You've probably been asked everything, but I really do go down in the weeds when I'm doing research on people, and I knew a lot about you anyway. But one of the things that struck me, I got really stuck on the page on the website about your guiding principles. And you don't have to go through verbatim what they are, but I think it speaks volumes about your sustainability, your commitment, your values. Can you just talk a little bit about them? And I only have a problem with one of them, and we can bring that up after you talk about them. You're going to love it.
Okay. Well, yeah, these guiding principles are about how how we organize our persona. And so I wish I could recite them all right.
No, but I mean, I can help because I have the joy of it. But you had a mindset
of what was going to happen here,
and there's transparency so that anybody's welcome. And there's grass base, which I want you to talk about. And then individuality. I'm like, what does that even mean? And as plants and animals should be provided a habitat that allows them to express their physiological distinctiveness.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Respecting the pigness. I love that. Of the pig. Yeah. I love it. I love whoever wrote this. And then here's the one I have issue with.
Guess who's the wordsmith?
His pigness, which we really do have to talk about that too. But community, nature's template, and earthworms. It's hysterical, and it's also very thoughtful. But my issue was, I was listening to one, I don't know, you know, you start listening to things and then they all turn into one voice, but we do not ship food. That's the community, which is so sustainable, it's so correct, except I was going to ask you, if we beg, would you ship me a turkey? I'm so just kidding. But when I heard about the turkeys, I'm like, I wouldn't consider eating a turkey farm-raised from what I know, but I would eat one of yours. So maybe that's when I have to come out there and visit you, spend some time, and then I'll get a turkey and I can take it home.
Yeah, well, you know, and let me be very, very open with you. That is the one that is now under tremendous assault right now. Anybody that's in the retail space knows that the whole retail interface in the food system is changing while we speak. I mean,
right.
The whole Amazon, Walmart, Ready Meal, Fresh Direct, you know, all this stuff, and so. You know, we are not far, I don't think, from allowing our shelf-stable, like we make a wonderful pork jerky, a 1 ounce pork stick, and we're getting ready to put that on Amazon, you know, so it can go anywhere. But that was
makes me really happy.
Yeah, the reason that we're compromising, if you will, on that one is because that was historically the travel food. That's what people took with them. They didn't, when they traveled on horseback, when Daniel Boone went to Kentucky, he didn't have zucchinis and squash and watermelons
right.
dangling from his
saddlebag. Or fresh turkeys, right.
No. He had pemmican. He had, dried beef. He had these extremely, fruit leather, okay? He had these extremely nutrient-dense things. And so, We're examining that a little bit, but we put together these 10 principles years ago when we started getting people saying, well, you need to franchise, you need to, and we were watching other people that were on our trajectory selling to, Quaker Oats.
Right.
And big, and so we said, we need to be proactive about this. We need to say, what do we really believe? And be aggressively proactive, so we're not reactive when the phone call comes and says, "I want to buy you for $10 million, and we can go, sit on the beach in Aruba." We don't want to sit on the beach in Aruba. We want to touch land. We have a gift for healing land, building soil, making happy earthworms, making landscapes that are aromatically and aesthetically sensually romantic, and so.
And you have to admit, Joel, that I've been doing this, we're in our 10th year, and yeah. I have looked at many websites, and never did I have in the list of things that I've read earthworms as a guiding principle. I was cracking up when I got down to the bottom and said, earthworms, we're really in the earthworm enhancement business. Stimulating yeah. soil biota is our first priority. Soil health creates healthy food, and I thought, that's the first. Earthworms as a guiding principle.
There's
just no downside to that. But you talked about this. This is a perfect segue to scalability. And I read or listened to a quote that you said, very powerful. If every farm in the United States would practice this system in fewer than 10 years, we would sequester all of the carbon that's been emitted since the beginning of the industrial age. So when you talk about, I'd like you to talk about that, like the system, and is it scalable? How can, first of all,
yeah.
is it scalable, and how can you do scalability without selling your soul? I mean, that's what
yeah.
happens.
Almost
always.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, you'd enjoy that in the last year I've spoken to the Virginia Association of CEOs and the Virginia Bankers Association, and both of them, the title of the speech was How to Scale Up Without Selling Your Soul. And these guys are wanting to hear this. They understand that tension, that pressure in the human spirit to scale up and sell their soul. So how we do this is there are two ways to scale. One is a single entity can scale up with infrastructure as a single entity, or you can scale up by duplication. There are two ways to scale. You can either scale by increasing a single business's footprint, or you can have a whole lot more footprints democratized.
Right.
And so our approach now, for sure, our approach can be scaled pretty big. I mean, you know, we're pushing a $3 million business.
So, right.
That's not Tyson, all right? So, I mean, there's plenty of room between a weekend hobbyist and Tyson, okay? So whether we want to argue on, well, what's too big? Is it a billion? Is it 500 million? Is it, you know, I don't want to have that argument. All I'll say is, you know, if it's honoring the pigness of the pig and growing earthworms and building soil, you know, you can go as far as your leadership team, your relational savvy, and some people are really good at building relationships and team dynamics, and other people aren't. Other organizations aren't. So what happens is the people element, how to hold the people together, actually becomes the size of the team determines the size of the scale of a single organization.
Right.
But there's no reason why, if you can't have a 50-person team, you can't have five functional 10-person teams. By the same token, if you have a one-person team, you don't have a team.
Right.
So I think it's important to understand that there is a low end of the scale in which it becomes non-viable. And I don't know where the upper level is, but I can assure you that it tends to be people-oriented, not infrastructure, resource, or land-based oriented. If you have a really gifted relational team that can hold together a 50, 60, 80-person team, you could have a pretty big, pretty big footprint. But your eyes to land are still going to be the same, whether you have individual entities or one large entity. So yes, this can absolutely scale. I mean, we're now managing a couple thousand acres here in the county. I never would have envisioned that, but this is land that people own, and they just come to us and say, we really like the way your farm looks. Can you make my farm look like that? My land look like that? So how do we say no to that? You know, we want to say yes, which means then that puts pressure on, well, if we're going to say yes to that as a land manager, we need to be able to sell what we produce on that land. That puts pressure on marketing. So all of these, the production, the processing, the marketing, the team dynamics, it all has to kind of rise at the same time. So scale. I mean, just imagine, for example, if there were no CAFO pig farms, concentrated animal feeding operation, CAFO pig farms, and instead all those pigs were out in forest glens in groups of 50. I mean, mesquite in Texas, pinyon pine in Northern California, the Appalachian hardwoods of Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia under oaks. I mean, there are millions upon millions upon millions of acres crying for caress, for human, intelligent, humble caress. You can call it exercise. You can call it massage. You can call it in permaculture. You can call it, resource teasing. I mean, there's a million ways to describe this. But the truth is that as a result of mechanical and intellectual investment in the land, it should become more productive and more abundant. Unfortunately, the story of civilization on land is the conquistador mentality. You know, we make it poorer. We leave deserts where gardens flourished. We leave scarcity where abundance was. And just because that is unfortunately the typical story of human civilization and interaction with our ecological umbilical, it doesn't have to be. And fortunately, we can flip that 180 degrees and use all of that intellectual and mechanical prowess to redeem, to build healing into our ecological womb and rectify all the damage that we've done. That is a very hopeful, profound vision,
which we so sorely need. And the underpinning of everything that you say, and it comes out so clearly, is respecting and honoring all that you're doing. It's that connection. It's not just a business for you. It's a life's work, and you set out to do some pretty important things and have, you know, values like earthworms. I love it. We'll be right back. And we come back, Joel, let's talk about what ain't normal, because I love that. Everybody, we'll be right back. Joel Salatin.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for being a part of it. If you just joined us, I invite you to push the button to rewind the podcast and hear the whole thing. Our guest is Joel Salatin. Joel and his family own and operate Polyface Farm in Swoop, Virginia. He is really and truly an American farmer and a lecturer and the author of 10 published books, which include Folks, This Ain't Normal, You Can Farm, and Salad Bar Beef. He was featured in Food, Inc., released in 2009, a very powerful documentary which literally changed the way millions of us eat. It certainly created cognitive dissonance in this person's brain. And he was also in the New York Times bestseller Omnivore's Dilemma. And Joel, there are three things I would love to cover before we run out of time, and it's going to go so fast. I think you should quickly say what we never even got into what all happens on the farm. I don't even know what salad bar beef is. And then pig-rated pork and poultry and eggs and rabbits. So talk about what the farm is. Then what ain't normal, because that's so important for how we have lost our way as an eating society. And then the last thing is, let's just save this to the end. I suffer from constant guilt and teeter-totting and, you know, bipolar, whatever, I'm schizophrenic about, should I eat meat or shouldn't I? So those are three big ones that we have to cover in 20 minutes. Let's start with what do you cover? What do you have on the farm?
Yeah, well, we're primarily a pastured livestock farm. We call ourselves grass farmers. This is legal grass, of course. This is the grass that you have in your lawn or on the edge of the road, okay?
Right, right.
And you know, we as Americans, we're very brain damaged about what grass is. When I say grass, people think of golf courses, lawns, and soccer fields, right? But actually, when I say grass, I'm talking about Laura Ingalls Wilder when they go to the soddy in Nebraska and they don't let the girls, Ma and Pa, don't let the girls run outside the house because they get lost. You know,
right,
we hear
right.
that. We say, if you did that at my house, the beautification committee would be in giving me a fine for, you know, letting my lawn grow up. And so I'm talking about the grass that was here. I mean, we're in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, where in about 1740, Governor Spotswood sent some buddies over. He called them the Knights of the Golden Horseshoe to scope out the valley, and they spent a couple of weeks, and they wrote letters back, and they said everywhere we rode in the valley, we could take the grass and tie it in a knot above the horse's saddle. It was a magnificent savanna silvopasture and of tall grass and widely spaced trees. And so what we're trying to do on our farm is recreate those symbiotic, synergistic, multi-speciated complex relationships between plants and animals that existed, that were part of the pre-European abundance. It comes as a surprise to a lot of people that in 500 years ago, what is today the United States actually produced more nutrition than it does today, even with, you know, hybrid seeds and chemical fertilizers and pesticides and John Deere tractors.
That's like mind-boggling, and I've heard it before, and I knew it's mind-boggling with all of the quote-unquote advances in technology.
Yeah.
Look what has happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had 200 million beavers. 8% of America's landscape was water in beaver ponds. This is before Army Corps of Engineers. You know, this is before Hoover Dam, TVA project. But they were much smaller. You know, they were much smaller scale. And you know, birds. I mean, Audubon sat under a tree in 1800 and recorded. Said I couldn't see the sun for 3 days because the flock of birds, they were passenger pigeons, flying overhead, blotted out the sun. Has anybody seen a flock of birds blot out the sun for 3 days? You know, and that was before Tyson. I mean, I could go on and on, but you know, and then you had the buffalo. You had the millions of wolves, each of which needed 20 pounds of meat a day. So there, and then you had elk and pronghorn deer and pheasants and prairie
right.
chickens, turkeys, and I mean the sheer volume of production was almost inconceivable. And so when you see that, you realize, well, there, what's the pattern then? I mean, if we're saying that was so abundant, well, what's the pattern? And the pattern is really quite simple. It's animals move. You know, we live in a time, we live in such an abnormal time that the orthodoxy of our day is, well, animals aren't supposed to move. They're supposed to be locked up in confinement houses, you know. And so you know, when we look at nature movies, you know, the Serengeti in Africa, that's the biggest you know, kind of natural place there is now. What you see is you see movement, don't you? You see these migratory bird flocks, you see herbivorous flocks, you see predator prey. And so how we duplicate this on private property, obviously we can't reinstitute the migratory patterns. Even if we had enough cows to have as many as 7 million in a herd like the you know, it wouldn't be a very reasonable thing to take a herd of 7 million cows from Florida and migrate them up to Ontario and back. You know, Starbucks wouldn't like all those cows going through their parking lot.
Right.
And so how do we duplicate this migratory choreography on privately owned blocks of land throughout the season? And so, fortunately, today we have really high tech stuff. We've got electric fencing. Which literally with a thread, we can run a spark through it and control a herd of 1,000 cows and steer them across the landscape with the same precision as a zero-turn mower on a golf course. So that electric fence becomes a steering wheel, an accelerator, and a brake on that four-legged sauerkraut vat that's pruning the vegetation, restarting its rapid biomass accumulation cycle, its juvenile growth period, through pruning, just like a viticulturalist would prune a vineyard, a grapevine, or an orchardist would prune an orchard tree. The herbivore prunes the biomass to restart, freshen up luxuriant growth so that it actually sequesters way more carbon than it would under static times. Now, pre-European, you had these large herds of bison and things, and when the vegetation got ahead of them, there would be a fire, either naturally started or Native Americans. You know, they didn't have chainsaws, so fire was their, you know, their pre-industrial freshening up agent. Today, we don't need to use the fire. We can use these herbivores under tight, controlled management with high-tech infrastructure. And how are they going to get shade? Well, so now we have, you know, bandsaw mills, so we can make Tinker Toy portable shade structures with webbed polyethylene nursery shade cloth on top, a portable shade tree, and move around with the animals so that we can have portable shade trees. Well, what about water? You know, they got it. Well, so now we have polyethylene black plastic pipe that we can bury. And so we have, you know, on our farm, we have 8 miles of buried water line that delivers gravity-fed water from permaculture-style ponds that we built up in the mountains. Fortunately, we didn't have to rely on the beavers to do it. We could use excavators to build these ponds, run this web network of pipe down. So we have 80-pound pressure water. That's about double your household pressure. Everywhere on the farm with no pumps, no electricity, just gravity in plastic pipes. And as long as we don't run above the initial, you know, intake, the water flows. So we can go uphill, downhill, all that, as long as we don't go above the initial intake. So water, shelter, and control, those are the three high-tech infrastructures that allow us then to move the animals around in this symbiotic choreography. So chickens follow cows, chickens scratch through the cow dung, eat out the fly larva, act as a biological sanitizer for the cow, for the herbivores. The herbivores move on and prune. They awaken the grasshoppers and crickets. The chickens turn those into eggs. We make compost with pigs. Pigs turn the compost. We call them piggerators.
I love that. Is that another Joel Salatin that you made up the word?
Yeah.
I've loved it. We got to make a hashtag out of it. Hashtag piggerator.
Hashtag
I might call some people that, though.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So you get the idea that the chickens and the cows, the turkeys, the pigs, everything is moving. So you mimic this basic movement pattern. And that's what we do.
It's unbelievable. There's a whole thing about, I hope people go to polyphasefarms.com and look at some of the stuff, because it's kind of like a stand-up comedy routine, only in words, because it's not your average website, and I loved it so much. Okay, so that was one. What about, I have to ask you before the time is up, and we still have some more time, but what ain't normal? We're not eating normally, but we cannot get off the show without you. Like, it's not literally hearing my confession, but the meat conversation is one of the most painful and common conversations in our family. Because my favorite thing in the world to eat, without question, if I had a, it should be its own food group, is bacon. Well, I just watched another film about how they eat pigs. And I committed once again, like I can never put it in my mouth again unless I know where that pig came from. So we have to go to that, but we ain't normal. Things ain't normal with the way we're eating. So that's all wrapped up in that question.
Sure it is. So let me attack it. I think this might help. If any of your listeners are savvy, they're probably familiar with things like the UN Long Shadow Report, or they may have seen the documentary Cowspiracy.
Yes, yes.
And now there's a sequel called What the Health, and that's What the Health, okay?
It's yes, What the Health. And we've had the Cowspiracy people on the show, yes.
Yeah, okay. So here's the deal. Here's the deal. Different metaphor. Let's assume that you're from Pluto, and the folks in Pluto say, you know, that Earth planet down there, let's go find out how they learn. How do they educate? How do they get smarts? So we're going to send a flying saucer with two delegates down there, and, you know, we're going to study their education system. So they plop a couple people in there, and or ETs or whatever, you know, and they send them down, and these guys happen to land in the poorest county, in the poorest state, in the poorest region, and they walk into the worst school with the worst teacher, with the worst principal in the country. And they observe things for 2 days, and they get their report together, and they jump in their flying saucer, head back to Pluto. What are they going to say in their report? Man, those Earthlings are some kind of poor. When if that's the kind of education we should have, we shouldn't even have an education. You know, that's the kind of it. That, my dear friends, is exactly what's happening with the whole meat debate. What you have are people with an agenda. It may be, you know, they worship animals, and, you know, my dog is my aunt, is my daughter, is my cow.
Right,
you know,
right.
It may be that they hate CAFOs or whatever, and I do too, all right? The point is that they go in and they study everything that's dysfunctional. That becomes the data point. The data point for everything becomes what's dysfunctional, not the few of us who are very functional and regenerative. And we don't enter into the reports. We don't enter into the documentaries. It's all this terrible dysfunctional system, which I agree with. You know, the irrigation, the destruction of aquifers, the grain-feeding herbivores, you know, all that stuff. Well, so then they when they take that data, then they say, okay, so here's how much, you know, soil it takes to grow a T-bone steak. Here's how much water it takes to grow a T-bone steak. Here's how many fish die with every pork chop you eat or whatever.
I can't believe I'm laughing. I'm sorry, but you're right. There's wisdom in these words.
Yes, yes. The whole data point set is coming from a grossly dysfunctional system. If you completely change the system, invert it 180 degrees, and you don't confine cows, but you use them in the historical herbivorous. Look, how did we get the deep prairie soils today that are growing corn and beans for tofu? We got it with these magnificent herds of herbivores.
Right. There is.
Okay.
Yes.
And so this notion that animals are inherently destructive to the environment is a completely indefensible ecological and nutritional position.
Okay, just press pause here for a minute. And is it not also true that it's not the animals, it's what man has done to corral them, shoot them with antibiotics, keep them contained, put them in machines that rotate? So it's we've obstructed the natural pattern. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I am very quick to tell people, look, don't demonize the cow. It's not her fault.
Right.
That the manager who has chosen to manage this wonderful, miraculous pruner, incubator, you know, converter of cellulose to nutrient-dense food, that manager has chosen to adulterate, and that's a strong word, but has chosen to adulterate everything that's beautiful about that animal and that relationship and that ecological niche that it's supposed to fill, adulterate that and turn all this beautiful into ugliness. You know, that can only be done by the hubris and creativity of a conquistador mind. And we're still suffering under that mentality.
And suffering greatly. And we literally have 2 minutes left, but I think in the final assessment and feedback that I have from you is, for me, Gina Murphy Darling, who suffers from extreme guilt if I eat meat, really do what you say. Care about where the animal came from, the kind of life it lived, and know your farmer. I mean, that is not a pithy statement to me. Know your farmer. We have a U of A, University of Arizona farm here, and you can go there and buy the meat. And I went down and interviewed them, and I said, you know, what's it like up until the end? And they're like, what do you mean the end? I went, I know, you know, when you kill them. And they told me they have a very happy life till the very last minute.
Yeah.
So it's okay. And it's the McDonald's and the fast food places that are just ravaging our bodies and our health and our rainforests that you're talking about.
Yes, and may I suggest that respect in life is what creates the sacredness of the sacrifice that then gives life. I mean, the idea that you can have life without death is completely anti-ecological. A compost pile is a perfect example of the level of life and death, which you've got is microbes, you know, eating and dying and being eaten. Everything is eating and being eaten. So the sacredness of life is whether you destroy a carrot or a pig or whatever, that in order to have life, there must be death. But how we create sacredness to that act and that sacrifice is the respect and honor we bestow on the life while it is living.
And what a note on which to end. I will tell you this. This is one of the most delightful interviews I have done. My face hurts from smiling. My heart feels very affirmed that there are people like you on the planet when I cover a lot of topics that don't have such delight and incredible, passionate information in it. So thank you. I know you're sought after, and I'm glad that you took the time to be a part of Mrs. Green's world. And thank you for all that you're doing. And I really mean it. When I say this, I hope our paths cross.
I do too.
You are a wonderful, wonderful word storm. Make it a great, green, intentionally lived week, everyone. Thanks for being a part of my world.